Hello, this is Larry Reedy, and welcome back, or welcome the first time to my podcast. Tonight, I have a special guest, Greg Neese, in business for himself, small business owner, interesting person, FFL dealer, and we're going to talk to Greg about his early life and have a few questions and then proceed into the business. Greg, welcome to my podcast.
Well, hello, Larry. Glad to be here.
So, Greg, were you born in Batesville?
Born in Batesville, lived here all my life except for military.
Okay, and how about grade school and high school?
Well, funny you ask that. I started out in grade school with your son, Rich. And that's when I first met you, in probably about 1981 or 82, because we would get out of school and run over to the Kawasaki shop so we could sit on the three-wheelers.
And then did you go on to Batesville High?
I did. Okay. I did. Yep. 4 years at Batesville, graduated and went straight in the military. I had 15 days to try to make some kind of transition.
Yeah. Well, when you were in grade school, what did you want to do when you grew up?
I wanted to be in the Army.
Okay. Same with high school.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. That's what I wanted to do.
You joined 15 days out of high school, basic training, Fort Knox?
Nope. I actually joined on the delayed entry. So I joined when I was 17, went through a year of recruitment training and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Fort Jackson.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So basic training afterwards, where'd you go?
I went straight to Fort Hood.
Fort Hood.
Yep.
For what was your MOS?
I was a 63 hotel. I was a track vehicle mechanic. So
okay.
I went straight down. I went straight to MOS or to AIT, which was on Edgewood Arsenal at Aberdeen Proving Grounds. So about 6 months living right on the bay. It was nice in the summer, but man, did it get cold.
Yeah.
The Chesapeake is not my choice for wintertime, that's for sure.
Well, did you spend your entire enlistment in the States? Or did
I
you?
Did. I did. I went straight to Fort Hood. They told us that we wouldn't leave. We would be there. As long as we were willing to stay in the military, we would be there.
So 3 years, 4 years?
Well, I was signed up originally on a three-year contract. I got hurt in training. So what I hoped would be a 20-year career got shortened to two in a few months, and ended up getting sent home. And then that was during the Clinton years with the drawdown. So even though I asked for a reclassification to stay in, I had to go to a medical board in front of a full board colonel who said from the Department of the Army he did not have the authority to reclassify me. Everyone got put out. So I came home, and I spent about 6 months trying to get back in. Did everything I could, and no one would take me. I had a good reenlistment code, but because of the drawdown, it just wasn't an option.
Wow. So the transition from military to civilian life when you came out, did you take some time off, or did you start a job immediately, or what happened?
It is a tough transition. You know, they say they put you through training to get you ready for it, but you know, only veterans understand what we go through and what they do to you when they reprogram you. So you know, I went through all that training, come home, still had no idea what I was doing. It's such a shock to be thrown into civilian life from where you were. I mean, I had just spent over 2 years being in a high-stress environment, and then to come home and just have nothing to do.
Yeah.
I was out for 9 days, actually, and I broke my hand. And so I was on Fort Hood when it happened, and I went to the hospital, and then they sent me to the VA. And I had my first eye-opener there, and so I had to have surgery, and it was a real mess. I came home, got a job, and it did take me quite a few years to transition from the military mentality to being a civilian again. But it takes time, but you can get there if you really put your mind to it.
I still have to keep my gig line straight. It drives me crazy if I see somebody with a belt off.
Yep, me too. Me too. I adjust mine all the time. And I have to fold my T-shirts a certain way.
Well, it took me over a year to understand why people walking couldn't stand step.
Yep.
And it's funny, but there's some things you just don't forget.
You don't forget it. They drill it into your head, and they teach you that it's the way of life, and it's hard to shake that. And the most of it is a really good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
But there are some things about it that isn't good because it doesn't fall into a civilian life. So right. You're the oddball in all situations, and those are the things that are hard to get past.
Well, you know, so far, and you know, this is recorded. I mean, this will be coming out in November. But a lot of the people that have been on here are all vets. And it's all the same thing. It's always a transition problem.
Yeah.
And not some have a lot harder times than others.
Yep.
And I was never in combat. You know, the Panamanian campaign. We had riots 2 years in a row. And as an MP... For 3 days 1 year and 4 days the other year, we worked 4 hours on and 2 hours off, 24/7 for 3 days and four days, and to keep people from cracking the lines.
Yeah.
So it's totally different than civilian life. But also, I'm sure you keep in touch with friends from the service.
Oh, I have many. I travel around and visit people and stay with them. And
yeah,
it's something I make sure that I do.
Yeah,
I always try to get around the country and see people that I know. And sometimes I just pick someone out and mail them something randomly that I like that I think they will, or something that I know they like, just because, you know, it makes somebody feel better to get something like that. So, you know, one thing I do remember when I first came home was feeling kind of guilty because I got 20 days of permissive TDY to come home to look for a job, get everything in line and make the transition. 3 days into my 20 days, all of my friends deployed to Iraq.
Whoa.
So I didn't know that. I went back at the end of my 20 days and everybody was gone. I had to do my final out and nobody was there. I had no idea what was going on. I went and asked somebody and they said, well, they all deployed. And, you know, then I come home and that was in 96, which was when Saddam Hussein had, you know, flooded the border and things started getting crazy. And then it led to what we have today. So I felt pretty guilty. Because a lot of, you know, my friends got stuck there, and those are the guys that I trained and that I trained with, and I wasn't there with them. And so I felt guilty for that. That was tough for a while.
Well, you know, I said, I'm still in touch with four guys that I was in the canal zone with that in, 59 to 61. So there's something about when you're in the service, because you're around people 24/7. Grade school and high school is the same, but not the same. You know, it's just you've got an everlasting bond.
Yeah, it's different.
And the vets. I mean, I've always tried to do something for veterans, and ever, you know, as long as I was able to when we weren't struggling raising seven kids, you know, but it's the honor flight. I'm going to be interviewing director of the honor flight out of Columbus, Ohio. They just do a super job, and they're, when you're old enough, you got to go. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
I've offered to be a helper.
Yeah, guardian.
Yeah. I've offered to do that. I didn't get any response, but I would always be willing to.
Larry did the same thing, and they when he did it, they had a 2-year waiting list.
Yeah.
But it's something. My oldest daughter was with me, and I think she got as much out of it as I did.
Yeah.
So it's something to do. Yeah. But so after, now you're discharged and you're trying to get used to civilian life. What was your first job, or did you just beat around a couple of them? Or
I kind of moved around from one thing to another. Moved back, did without intention. If I wouldn't have broke my hand, I wouldn't have. But I moved back in with my mom and dad, and needless to say, they weren't real impressed with the lifestyle I had. So it lasted a little while, and then my dad told me I needed to get out and find my own place. So I just bought a house, but I just beat around from one job to another, making money.
Yeah.
Whatever got me by from day to day. Spent a lot of time in the gym and training, and like I said, trying to hopefully get back in. And when that all fell apart, I just kind of settled down and mm-hmm. went from there with it. And you know, I eventually, even though I always had a knack for working on things and fixing things, and I liked being a mechanic, I got tired of that. So I fell in where so many other people do, and I went to Hill-Rom, and you know, I was there 8 years, and I was there 6 months, and I remember one night, I was on second shift, and it was miserable. I was there on second shift one night on a Friday, and they had posted on the board the Indiana Wesleyan used to come to Batesville, mm-hmm. and Hill and Brandt's kind of paid for it and gave them a place to do it. So I thought, you know what, I'm sick of working in a factory, and I'm not doing this. So I got to looking into it and signed up, and that's kind of got me where I am today, just because I took the initiative and I learned so much from it, and I just kept going with it. So it was.
So you, after the 8 years at Hill-Rom, is that when you started an insurance business?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was just kind of by an accident. I had graduated college with a business degree, and I was, I think 6 months after that, I had tooled around, you know, trying to get a few, moving up in Hill-Rom, didn't know really what I wanted to do. They offered me a few jobs, but I'd have to travel. And the more I thought about that, I didn't know. At that time, I wasn't much into traveling, so I didn't know how much I would like spending 75 to 80% of my time on the road. Hmm. So I just started looking around, and, you know, back then, the internet wasn't what it is now. So I just took my resume and I emailed it to everybody, and all I would attach it. And then I would say, you know, please forward. And it got around and around. And then I walked in one day at Farm Bureau to pay my insurance bill. And Brian Voss said, "Hey, I saw your, resume. Are you still looking for a job?" And I had spoke to him about insurance probably 5-6 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
And, I said, "Yeah." I said, "I guess I am, whatever." And he said, "Well, we got an opening if you're still interested." I said, "Yeah." I said, I guess I would be." And then about a week later, I got a phone call, and it went to a voicemail, and I picked it back up, and I listened for like 10 seconds, and I thought, "I don't know that voice," and I paid my bill, so I hung my phone up. And then I thought, well, I better listen to it again. So I listened to it, and it was Terry Toops from Osgood, who ended up being my manager there for 10 years. And she just called me to see if I wanted to come in to interview. And I did. And from there, it just kept going. And once I got started in it, I don't know, I guess I liked it. So I didn't really want to change.
So with Farm Bureau and State Farm, I don't know, what do you, your lines today, or your multi-line dealer?
I do everything but health insurance. So Obama ruined that, so I gave that up.
Okay.
But everything else I do.
Is it Farm Bureau or another?
No, I'm independent.
You're so independent, I've used various companies.
Yeah, I've got hundreds of companies that
well,
I
see, do. I had a rude awakening, because I started out selling life insurance for Metropolitan Life. Mm-hmm. And great experience, but, you know, unless you're into the multi lines, there's no renewals, and
it's tough.
Yeah, it's tough. So, maybe I don't know, it might have been 15 or 20 years ago, as I was getting older and the kids were all gone here, I had insurance with State Farm, with Paul Ehrman. Mm-hmm. And I was looking over the policy, and so I went into the office, and I said, I just want to understand one thing. If a tornado or something destroyed our home, I said, we're empty nesters now. I know what my home's insured for, but what if we just wanted to build a two-bedroom ranch? Said, well, that's what we'd pay for, two-bedroom ranch. Said, what if we didn't build anything? Well, we wait for you to build something. So, you know, basically, and maybe not that, but I remember it wasn't what the house was insured for. So anyway, I talked to other people, and I wound up with an executive policy where it's a cash payout. I mean, mm-hmm. Pay through the nose for it. It's, I think it's $3,000 a year with a $10,000 deductible. Mm-hmm. But if you have $50,000 damage, they waive the $10,000. And I've often wondered, is this a standard practice with most companies where they pay for what you build if you have a total loss, unless you're into certain companies that have that executive thing?
So I could go in and spend hours talking about this. There's a lot to it. Uh-huh. Insurance is indemnification. And indemnification is to give you back what you had, same, like, kind, or quality. That's the definition of, yes, insurance. So then there's contractual things that go along with that. If you don't bill back the same thing, depending on the company and the adjuster, they'll make agreements with you. I have only seen a few instances where they just paid out, and that's because they didn't have a mortgage. If somebody has a mortgage, you have no choice. You have to make that work for the bank, right. Because it's set up with equity with the bank. So you don't really have a lot of choice there. If you don't have a mortgage, you can make a deal with the insurance company, but the best thing is always build back what you have, and then if you want to sell that, you can sell it.
Okay.
But if you're going to build something small and you had it insured for the amount of what your house was worth, which in Indiana, that's what you have to do. We got to do a replacement cost estimator, determine the value of the reconstruction cost. And a lot of people think, well, my house appraises for this. Appraisals and assessing, that has nothing to do with insurance. Those are totally different amounts. Everything is based on reconstruction. So we have to use a third-party vendor, and you enter all the information, and they give you back what your reconstruction cost would be, and that's what you insure for, 80% the value.
Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, what, because I wonder, obviously I didn't have a mortgage on the house or anything, and I thought, and again, not ever selling other than life insurance, never casualty and homeowners or anything, I thought that was kind of strange, but I remember Paul said, no, that's standard of the industry. I can understand that, especially if you have a mortgage. But I'm thinking, my God, if at the time, say we would have been 75 years old, I mean, that's a house designed to raise 7 kids in.
Yep.
And we would never build anything back, yeah, like that. But by paying the premium for, have the house insured to do it, and then, maybe spending half of what the house is insured for, and that's all you're going to get paid.
And cash out the rest.
Yeah.
I have had a few situations where they will just pay out the limits of the policy if there's no mortgage, mm-hmm, because they want to wipe their hands of it. They don't want you coming back later and saying, well, we need more for this, we need more for this. They just want to pay it out and be done with it. I have seen some like that with no mortgage. It just depends on the company and what they want to do at the time.
Yeah. And well, and I think, and again, I don't know, some of the adjusters, if it seems like if an adjuster works for the insured company, it's pretty good, pretty reasonable. But if it's a floating adjuster, boy, he's out to save the company money, because that's what he's going to get some pay. Money.
He's going to get a bonus, and that's what he's looking for.
And we've had a fortunately business never had one bad claim that I felt the adjuster and the insurance company handled the wrong way, because we were in the right. The guy complaining was in the wrong. Everybody knew it, but they didn't want to take a chance on a jury that might hate motorcycles or hate insurance companies. And they paid out money that, I mean, it never happened.
A lot of times they know that maybe it'll cost them $30,000 or $50,000 to defend against it. They'll just offer $25,000. And most people, they'll just take that quick money.
Yeah.
Well, I shouldn't say most. Some people, they're just out for the money, and they'll take that quick money. They can get it quick, they'll take it. Well, and they know that.
We're going to take a break for a minute, have a drink of water, and we'll be back shortly. And let's save a little music while we're off. Okay, we're back now, and have a drink of water and collect our thoughts a little bit. And one thing, back on the insurance program, are many of the young people interested in getting into the insurance business?
I have people ask me about it, and it's not that I want to discourage someone, but what people don't understand, I had a very rare opportunity with Farm Bureau. I walked in, they gave me a salary, they gave me commissions, they gave me bonuses, they gave me everything. And it doesn't matter how I feel about them, about the company now, at the time, they gave me the opportunity of a lifetime. They really got me going to where I am today. They trained me, they put me through all of it. I had all my own licensing, I did all that myself, but as far as training in the insurance industry, because there's a lot to it. It's you can just be an agent, but then you can also be an agent that actually knows how it works. And I mean, I have spent hundreds of hours in classes and learning from the executive level down how insurance works, because that helps me be a better agent and it helps me understand how things are done for the insured. It helped me a lot. So I felt like I needed 10 years before I could be independent. I spent 10 years almost to the day at Farm Bureau, and I resigned. I resigned because the company was going a direction I did not really want to go with them. So I was happy to be out on my own and do my own thing. I discourage people from it now if they're not in the perfect situation, because the opportunity isn't there anymore like I had. So to just jump into it and try to make a go of it, you better have a monthly income. When I went independent, I went 6 months with no pay. You know, you go from, with the lifestyle that I had acquired, you go from that to zero. It'll humble you real quick. I sold every toy that I had. I sold my truck. I sold everything I had that I could get rid of to make a go of this. And fortunately, it did. But I had a lot of very good clients who followed me, people who supported me. It worked out for me. You know, I spent a lot of time eating cereal and ramen just to put it together. But in the end, it's worth it. It's very hard. People ask me now, you know, could I do this? No, I don't think you could.
It's hard.
Only if you have that support. If you have, you know, if you have a spouse that makes enough that they can support the household while you make a go of it, absolutely. But if you're a single income person, it'd be almost impossible. If you have to pay your bills, it'd be almost impossible. If you think that you're going to jump in and make enough commission month one to pay your bills, there's just no way. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's months where you make $500.
Yeah.
If you're lucky. Yeah. There's months where you make zero. But then there's months where you have chargebacks and you're negative. In those months, you get two or three of them in a row, you better have something to fall back on or you ain't going to make it. Yeah. So,
well, it's kind of like real estate. You know, you don't see too many young people going into real estate. You see you see a lot of women who they're empty nesters. They decide they want to go into real estate. Yeah. And they can do it because you might go 6 months in real estate without closing on a house.
Yeah, I did that too.
Well, did you?
I sold real estate when I was in college. And it's again, tough. I had good support. I worked at Hillrom. I knew everybody around my job at Hillrom. I talked to everybody. So I'd be doing my thing at work and everybody would stop me. Hey, I want to buy this house. Hey, I want to sell my house. Can you help me out? Yep, I can do it. Yeah. So, yeah. It's a tough go no matter what.
I have a funny story. We were in Hilton Head with my CPA and his wife. This is years and years ago. And there's a neat restaurant right on the water. It's called Hudson's. And so we went to Hudson's and had this male waiter wait on four or five tables at a time. No paper and pencil, everything upstairs. He remembered everything. Somebody would pull a cigarette out of the pocket. He could be on one side of the room, go over and light their cigarette and come back. So at the end of the evening, we were late diners that night, and he came over to the table and he said, you people from Cincinnati? I said, well, yeah. He said, well, you got that Cincinnati accent. And I said, well, where are you from? He says, Columbus. He said, I graduated from Ohio State. I said, oh, really? So what do you do besides this? He said, well, I've got a real estate license. I said, really? I said, so this is part-time? No, he said, real estate's part-time. He said, yeah. I can't make as much in real estate as I make here. No. And I said, really? He said, well, he said, tonight, he said, in three services, I had 15 tables. He said, this isn't a cheap restaurant. And he said, we don't have cheap tippers, do we? So anyway, make a long story short, 2 years later, Nancy and I are back at Hilton Head by ourselves. Or no, we had some of the kids with us. But we went out for dinner that night without him. We're standing in line waiting for a seat. This guy comes up, taps me on the back, and says, "How's everything in Batesville?" Now, you know, unbelievable memory. Here's a guy that, and, you know, Hilton Head real estate isn't cheap. Yep. But he enjoyed what he was doing, and he figured that he could make some money selling real estate, which he was doing. He had a great personality. But his thing was being a server in a restaurant. Yep. So,
you know, from the time that I started in insurance, what I found people appreciated the most was just being personable.
Yep.
I never tried to sell somebody something as much as I tried to take care of them. Offer them something better. You know, hey, can I quote you? If I'm cheaper, I am. If I'm not, I'm not. I understand that. It's a matter of caring about what's going to be better for them and what's going to help them get where they want to be. I've given a lot of advice. If I don't know something, I will ask someone that knows. Because there's always somebody that knows something that I don't know, knows more than me about this or that. I always make sure that I try to go above and beyond to help people out with that. And it seems like that's what they appreciate. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was a Farm Bureau, I had to sell a lot of life insurance. And they always said, "How do you sell so much?" I don't sell it. It sells itself.
Yeah.
You go see people, you get to know them, they remember that you can take care of them. And you're not trying to do it just to make as much as you can on them. You're actually trying to help them out.
Absolutely.
And it worked better.
Absolutely. And
I ended up being friends with the vast majority of my clients, still am today. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just an occasional hi by text or by Facebook, it's always something. I mean, I've grown big enough now that it's hard for me to keep in contact with everybody. Yeah. But, you know, in my early days in it, I just made sure that I always kept in contact. I didn't sit in the office. I'd get in my car and I started out in Lawrenceburg in Dearborn County. I'd get in my car and my truck and I'd drive up to Bright and I'd go from one person to another that I knew and, you know, take them to lunch or they take me to lunch or just sit around and talk. And other people would stop in and it would spread easy like that because people know that you're not just, you don't just stop in to collect checks.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what we got, third generation people buying bikes up to, mm-hmm. you know, the up from Larry and Matt. And do you know Eric Menner?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Got a funny story. This guy keeps looking at me in Kroger. And he looked familiar, but now I haven't seen Eric Menner in years. His brother Ron did sign work for me and everything. But so Eric came up and said, "You know who I am?" He said, "The face is there," but he said, "Eric Menner." I said, "Geez, Eric, I haven't seen you in a long time." So we're talking, and we're walking out to the car together. And I said, "Hey, Eric." "What?" I said, "CSR 650, April 1981. He said, "I can't remember what I had to eat last night." But, you know, it's funny because all these people over the years that you've dealt with, and you can replace the face, but as you get older, you just can't remember all the names. But as soon as he said, he didn't have to say Menner. As soon as he said Eric, I knew who it was. But he changed in 40 years.
Yeah. So I write business in 9 states. I travel all over the country. And I normally run into somebody I know.
Now, so do you have to have a license in each state?
Most states are reciprocal. So with my Indiana license, some states don't cost anything to get a license in that state. Some I got to pay.
Okay.
But either way, it's reciprocity. You just go ahead and sign up in the state.
Well, it's kind of like the before Indiana, you didn't have to have a license, concealed carry. We had a, Nancy and I always had concealed carry Indiana license. But years ago, like Ohio wouldn't even recognize Indiana and a few others. So we got our license in Florida that covered, I think, 38 states or so. And the interesting thing, when we had to take a class there, over 30% were women. And this goes back 20-some years ago. So
I've had my Utah for 10 or so.
But they see now Indiana's pretty much, you know, unless you go to the crazy states like
places
New York.
You don't want to go.
I don't want to go there. I've been there, done that.
A few years ago, I was in D.C., and even as an FFL, I called the D.C. police because I did not want to get pulled over and get in trouble. I called, and I said, you know, what can and can't I do? And the desk sergeant said, well, your best bet is to unload and hide, take apart, put, you know, in your luggage in the trunk, hide it away. Don't have it accessible. That's how you're going to be legal. But she said, your best bet, don't carry a gun to D.C.
Really? Mm-hmm. And the crime is rampant.
Terrible. But it's not one of the 50 states.
Well, I know that.
So they don't have to be reciprocal with nothing. But, you know, I mean, even as an FFL, I'm licensed to buy and carry in all 50 states, not conceal carry, but to have on me in all 50 states. But even there, she said, don't. Because if nothing else, I would be taken into police station and have to sit there until I can prove.
That's just crazy.
It's just, you know, taking up my time. So I went to D.C. and I stayed in Virginia, and I left my handgun in Virginia to go to D.C. So.
Well, now that we're talking about guns, my favorite subject.
Mine too.
We could talk a little about this. And how long have you had your FFL? Federal firearms license, for people that don't know, that is your ability to buy and sell ammo, handguns, rifles, whatever.
5 years.
5 years.
Yeah, 5 years. I kicked it around for a long time, and then I just went ahead and did it. Thought it was best for me because of how much that I do myself. So it works good for me.
Mm-hmm. And the do you have one distributor for yourself? Or?
I have several. The problem is I don't have a brick and mortar storefront. So without that, a lot of them won't deal with you now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I still have a handful of distributors. I usually deal with Davidson's. They're very good. But a lot of the bigger guys that others had told me to, you know, talk to them, they don't do it. They won't deal with you unless you're brick and mortar. I tried to get, I can't buy Leupold. Davidson's won't sell it to me because I'm not a licensed distributor from Leupold. So I contacted them and I said, what's it going to take? And they said, well, you got to have a brick and mortar store or we won't do it. And I said, well, I do, cause I work out of my office. I said, well, I do. And the guy said, well, you're going to have to send us a picture of your storefront, your business sign, your inventory, your display, a whole list of stuff. And I don't really want to sell. I don't want to send them pictures of things like that.
Yeah.
So I just choose to go a different direction.
Well, you know, it's the gun dealers today, the small guy is really going to have problems because like in Cincinnati, you got, I don't know how many stores On Target has, and they got great shooting ranges, got a lot of money tied up in it, and then you got RK Guns, Rural King, and Bass Pro Shops.
Yeah, you can't touch RK.
Yeah,
it's tough.
Yeah, it's well, you know, and the nice thing though about dealing with like in Indiana Gun Club or Rusty Buck and Versailles, nice people. In fact, I heard he's going to open one in Batesville. Have you heard that?
No, I hadn't, but that would be, well, be all right.
The Harley repair shop.
Yep.
Cops.
Yep.
He sold them the building, from what I understand. Okay. And he's going to bring his gun shop to,
okay,
to Batesville.
That'd be good.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, because Mike up in Greensburg, he basically has turned that over to his son, and his son's doing tactical stuff and training. And I don't know why he didn't make it, because he sold a lot of guns initially.
Yeah.
But I think it kind of dried up with COVID.
Yeah, I'm sure Rural King puts the hurt on him, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so how active are you with the federal firearms license?
Now, lately, mostly transfers.
Yeah.
A lot of gun broker stuff comes to me.
Explain.
Gun broker is just an online auction.
Okay.
Online auction or purchase website, and then they just have to ship it to an FFL.
Right.
And then I do the background check, so...
So, yeah, and what is that, $50, $100 to do that? Or,
well, I've always been 25, but I think I'm pretty cheap compared to everybody else. So.
I would think so. Maybe it's 25 for your insurance customers.
Yeah.
Something like
that.
Yeah,
that's probably why I get so many. You know, the only bad part about it is I have to schedule my day around the UPS or the FedEx guy that's going to be dropping something off for me.
Yeah.
So...
Because I imagine you have to sign, don't you?
I'll have to be signed 21 and over. The bad thing is people can send to me and I don't even know it. It'll just show up.
Oh.
It just depends on who they buy from them, what they're, what they need. If I'm already listed as an FFL and they have my info, sometimes they'll just ship it to me and it just shows up.
Really?
The only problem I've ever had is FedEx. They're kind of weird about how they do things, and I've had guns just left on my porch, which is a federal offense. It's a terrible thing to even try to mess with.
Oh, wow.
I had a handgun shipped from a police department in Tennessee to me for a police officer here, and it was just left on my porch.
Oh, boy.
And it was FedEx, and it was during COVID, and the guy just... He just put his initials on it and threw it on my porch and left. And so I came home and I saw it, and before I even touched it, I called FedEx and I told them, this is what's going on. They don't do anything about
it.
No,
they can't.
It just keeps on. They have them contractors, and it is what it is.
Some of these FedEx drivers, I mean, they're working so many hours.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, they have 200-300 stops a day, and they know they can't do more than 100.
Yeah.
So the stuff gets carried over to the next day and the next day. And, they just want to dump the stuff off. And I understand, but they don't know what's in that package.
Yeah.
It just says needs a signature. They don't know what it is. But I really like it when people send stuff UPS. That works much better.
Well, either UPS or FedEx, when I order ammo, I order 1,000 rounds at a time. Mm-hmm. They all know me. They just drop at the front door.
Yeah, because, same with me.
Yeah, so it's and the ammo, some of it's coming down now. The 9mm's about what, 40 cents a round now?
Depends on where you get it from.
Yeah.
Sometimes I can get it cheaper than that through my suppliers.
Yeah, and but 44 Magnum, 357 Magnum. That's just crazy.
Nobody
stuff.
Even asked for it anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, very little. If I can find it, it's high. 2 years ago, in the last quarter of, I think I did $30,000 in ammo in that quarter.
Really?
And I was driving sometimes 2 hours to meet suppliers and load my vehicle up. And by the time I got back to Batesville, most of it was sold.
Yeah. Yeah.
So... That was a pretty good year. My dad and I spent a lot of time running miles on my car. So. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you can, especially if you're shooting an AR. If I shoot an AR, I shoot 200 rounds minimum.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just because they're fun. They got the range to do it. But the 44 Magnums, I've got four of them, and I really, really like them. And I think the last time I bought, maybe $170 around. Yeah. I mean, that's just nuts. I had an old box buried in one of the safes, a box of 50. It was $28.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. For a while there, 308 was like that. I shoot a lot of 308. I couldn't touch it for less than $2 a round for a while. It was just nuts. Sometimes 250.
And now it's still, what, 80 cents a round?
It's high. Yeah. It's high.
Yeah, because I always bought 500 rounds of 308, and I was paying 60 cents before they went crazy.
That's usually what I hunt with, so I don't shoot a lot of it.
Yeah.
I do a little practice here and there, but other than that, I don't shoot a lot. Most of what I put through that is all hunting rounds. So once I know my scope's good, I don't mess with it too much. But 223, 5.56, and 9mm, I shoot a lot of that.
Yeah.
But I've gone to 22 long because I've got so much of it, and it's so much less.
Yeah, I think I've got 13,000 rounds of it, something like that.
I
always picked it up when it was cheap. And
me too.
And they're it's fun to shoot.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of 22s, the Ruger, the Smiths, all of them. And, the 22 Magnum might be a good home protection pistol, except after you fire a couple rounds, there's so much smoke, you're not going to be able to see who you're shooting at.
Yeah. So. I have probably my favorite self-defense. It's too big to really carry it for much, but I throw it on my four-wheeler a lot when I'm in the mountains or whatever. I got a Judge, and I really like that thing. 45 long Colt, a 410. I carry, and I can shoot snakes with it. If I get in a deliverance-type situation, I can shoot rednecks with it.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes. It'll do it all. So
I've got like a Smith Governor with it, and it does the same except 45 ACP with moon clips. And I've got a laser on it. And, I mean, it's fun to shoot. But the neat thing is that, I try to have a class or two for women, and I take them through 22, 380s, 9mm, stop at, 9mm. And I always ask them, you want to shoot an AR? It's like, he asked me to go to the prom. Because they get up there, they love shooting an AR because there's no recoil.
Nope.
And I've got the scopes zeroed at 200 yards. So they hit steel the first time they shoot it.
Yep.
And it's really, really fun to do.
And it's an eye-opener to them as to what it really is as compared to what they talk about it being.
Yeah, assault rifle. Yeah. What's an assault rifle? It's a semi-automatic rifle. It's stupid. So, but I haven't been shooting a lot lately. I found that something, except for my trigger finger, my right hand, I've got so much arthritis in it, it's unbelievable. And the doctor said, he had swelled up on me, and I went in to see him, and he did x-rays, and he said, you got bone spurs, you got tears, you got everything. He said, but your index finger's okay. I said, that's okay. I can put up with the rest of it.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I could shoot with my middle finger.
I would find a way. I would make it happen.
So, any advice for young people that, it doesn't have to be insurance, but just the work ethic. I mean, it drives me crazy. I don't see how kids in high school aren't working at McDonald's or flipping burgers someplace or doing anything, delivering pizzas. And don't get me, I'm not putting everybody in the same thing, but it seems like with a lot of two parents working, they spoil the kids and they give them an allowance instead of telling them, hey, go out and make your own money if you're going to spend it. So any advice for?
Nothing's free. You got to earn it. If you want to appreciate it, you got to earn it. If it's given to you, you don't appreciate it much. You know, I never had anything given to me, and I busted my butt all the way through, and I found a way to make it work. And along the way doing that, you can enjoy the experience.
Yeah.
You know, I tell people I've emptied my bucket at least once, and I started filling it back up again. And my bucket is mostly traveling, hunting places, things that I enjoy that I want to do. Mm-hmm. I've done. There's so many things that I thought, man, that would be cool to do, and I find a way to make that happen. But you can only do that through hard work.
Yeah.
You have to work hard to get there. And, you know, a lot of people will, I hear the comment a lot, and it's kind of a thing we kid about, but people say, must be nice. Well, you know, when I hear people say that, the one thing that comes to mind, it must be nice now, but you weren't there for the work.
Yeah.
You didn't see the hard work that went in to get there.
Yeah.
Hard work always pays off, even if you think it don't. It does if you have the right attitude, but you know you just have to earn it. Yep. And if you work hard and work your way through it,
but how do you convey that to young people today?
It's tough. You know, as a dad, I've made my mistakes as far as, you know, being maybe too lenient on my daughter or giving too much, and that comes back to bite me later. But then you got to use that discipline still. She's only 13, so
yeah.
I try to do it based on the age. But you have to instill that in your kids, and they need to see that. When they see that, it makes them understand that's what gets them where they want to be. But you know, I hear people say, "Well, no matter how hard I work, it doesn't work out." That's your problem. It's your attitude.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
It's all what you put into it,
and hopefully, thanks. You know. Nancy and I are at the age, nothing's going to bother us. Our kids are all doing well, but I worry about grandkids, future generations, because this country, in fact, the whole world's really screwed up right now.
It is.
I mean, and they got to get back to the basics. And before you came, I was talking to one of my neighbors, you know, the Norwalds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't talked to him. We always waved to each other, but it's probably been 25 years. And so he stopped at the driveway, and we talked for about 20, 25 minutes. And 85 years old, still out there on that combine, the tractor, milking those cows. And he was telling me about now they got robots for doing some of the milking. Yeah. He said, while I'm talking to you, he said, 60 cows are being milked right now. So it's, you know, it's that generation and all his kids have grown up the same way. But I don't know about his kids' kids, you know. And again, fortunately, I think all of my grandkids have a good work ethic because it was instilled in all the kids, and they didn't hand them anything. They had to work for it. So
I see, knowing your family, I see that most of your kids got that from you. They seen what you and Nancy did, and I got that from my dad, watching what my dad did, you know, day in and day out, knowing what it takes to get there. Nothing's free. And if it is, it ain't worth it.
No. It's no fun. You know, when you have a destination plan, I don't care if it's a trip or something in life, retirement, whatever, the fun is getting to the end of your journey.
Absolutely.
It's not just saying, well, I'm here. Yep. You have to work for it. You have the struggles that go along with it. And like, I don't know how many hand-me-down tough skins from Sears that the boys got. when they were kids. And you know, it's just a way of life. But today, I mean, you see kids with $50 polo shirts or Under Armour shirts,
or a new car pulling into the school parking lot.
Yeah, in high school. I mean, that's no, just no way.
No,
it's, they're and parents might think they're doing them a favor, but they're really not.
It's a disservice to your kids, very much, because they're not going to know what to do in a couple years.
Yeah,
when they get slapped straight in the face with reality. So,
well, Greg, we've been on for almost an hour, so I guess it's time to wrap things up here. And I really appreciate you coming out here, taking some time out of your day. Had a little fun, a few laughs. I hope our friends listening will enjoy it. And I'm not going to call anybody an audience anymore, because the thing is, the whole idea of this is to have people listen, and they're thinking they feel like they're sitting at a table talking. No rehearse. I don't edit things. If I make mistakes, that's life, you know. If you're at a restaurant talking to somebody, there's no do-overs. You know, you say what you say, and that's it. So, and I think so far the reaction's been pretty good.
I like it. I listen every week.
Yeah, well, it's fun, and I got a couple really good ones coming up. So, anyway, thanks again. I appreciate it, and let's play a little bit of the national anthem here. And thanks everybody for listening again. And remember, faith, family, friends, country, everything else is background music. God bless you. God bless the United States of America. Thanks again. I'll talk to you on the next podcast.